Today is Thursday, May 31st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, why an outspoken Russian journalist faked his own death.
Since July of 2016, there have been 5 high-profile assassinations in Kyiv alone.
In the crisis in Gaza, is it reaching a breaking point?
It's a simple humanitarian disaster. Within about 10 years, there literally will be no drinkable water in Gaza.
Also ahead, is the U.S. about to follow through on its threat to impose tariffs on its European allies? It's all on today's International Edition. With the help of Egyptian mediation Wednesday, Israel and Hamas appear to have pulled back from a fourth war after a day of intense rocket fire and airstrikes, but the situation could explode at any moment. UN Mideast envoy Nikolai Medvedev said the hostilities between Hamas and Israel are reaching a breaking point.
I'm afraid that the last 2 days have seen the most serious escalation since the 2014 conflict between Hamas and Israel. And they have been a warning to all of us how close we are to the brink of war every day.
Tensions along the border have been high for 2 months, with Palestinians holding protests, calling for a right to return to land they fled or were forced to leave when Israel was created in 1948. They've also rallied against a blockade of Gaza, as well as the relocation of the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. VOA's Victor Beatty got reaction from Michael Fishbach, professor of history at Randolph-Macon College in Virginia.
The sad reality is that Gaza is the world's biggest open-air prison. And regardless of one's sentiments, whether one defends the Israelis or supports the Palestinian cause, the reality is that there are some 2 million humans that really have nowhere to go. The Egyptians are blockaded. You know, they can't get out to Egypt. The Israelis don't let them out. Can't travel by sea. Fishing boats were attacked quite recently. Beyond the politics of things like Palestinian refugees going to the fence, demanding their right of return to their homes inside of Israel, it's a simple humanitarian disaster that is Gaza. Within about 10 years, there literally will be no drinkable water in Gaza. Beyond unemployment, beyond poverty, there's serious malnutrition, and it's just a powder keg. And the fact that the Palestinian-Israeli peace process is frozen, I mean, that works for Israelis because they live their lives in relative stability and normality. But for Gaza, it does not work. It's a tremendous challenge to Israel, to the Palestinian Authority and its leadership in the West Bank, and I think to the wider world, that this is a humanitarian disaster. And so these kind of outbursts, whether it was the demonstrations at the fence or this recent violence, is really quite predictable, and it's lamentable.
What caused the latest exchange?
I think it's a follow-up. There could be various power struggles within Hamas and for instance, Islamic Jihad, but I think it's a follow-up on the global attention that was focused on the Gaza situation because of the demonstrations at the border fence, the fact that the worst violence as Israeli troops shot over the border into Gaza also occurred on the day the U.S. Embassy moved to Jerusalem. It brought some international attention to the, again, not just the politics of the situation, the unresolved Arab-Israeli or Palestinian-Israeli peace process, but also the sheer humanitarian problem. And I think for some, it's a way to keep the focus on Gaza and not let the world's attention be shifted elsewhere.
Are you afraid that perhaps more such exchanges will occur in the future?
I do. What it reminds me of is the situation of Iraq in the 90s, when Iraq was subject after 1991 to UN sanctions. And every so often, the Americans and at least for a time, the British had a no-fly zone, and every once in a while, the Iraqi forces were ordered by then-President Saddam Hussein to fire missiles. And, of course, there would be a counterattack. And I remember people saying, why do the Iraqis do that? They know they're going to get crushed. And really, the answer is the same thing about why Hamas does things. The sad reality is, in the absence of some sort of crisis, everybody would just forgot about Iraq and, you know, the 500,000 children who died because of the sanctions. And I think, however lamentable, sometimes these cross-border attacks, that the ones that I should say that are initiated by the Palestinians in Gaza, if for no other purpose, serve as to draw the world's attention that there still is this unresolved problem there. Again, for people interested in peace, the unfortunate reality is if you have these situations of no peace, no war, but one side is really suffering. Its civilian population is really suffering. It's almost inevitable that there'll be some sort of armed conflict that will jar the world's attention, as indeed the UN Security Council is supposed to be meeting about this issue.
All right, that's Michael Fishbach, professor of history at Randolph-Macon College in Virginia. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Thousands of foreign nationals may lose the right to stay in the U.S. President Trump says he wishes he'd picked another attorney general. Trump asks ABC for an apology after the flap over comedian Roseanne Barr's racist comments. Trump gives personal or terminal patients the right to try experimental drugs. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. China on Wednesday lambasted U.S. policy after President Trump said he was moving to finalize trade sanctions against it, even as a U.S. delegation arrived in Beijing for talks. 10 days ago, the White House announced a truce in trade hostilities with China, with Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin saying that threatened tariffs on Chinese goods were on hold. But on Tuesday evening, it said that sanctions announced in March, largely focused on China's theft of U.S. intellectual property, were still in the works. U.S. Chamber of Commerce President William Zari.
Tariffs is a blunt instrument, and sometimes there is collateral damage. And yet the upside of that, what the administration is doing, is that we are actually in very intense negotiations with China now in a way that we haven't been for so many years. The thinking was, and even before this administration took power, the thinking became that if we don't have any leverage, the U.S. doesn't have any leverage, and there's no pressure on our Chinese friends, that we will not have serious negotiations.
Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron gave an impassioned speech about international cooperation Wednesday, 2 days before the Trump administration decides whether to hit Europe with punishing steel and aluminum tariffs. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross and U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer are attending meetings at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris. The EU is threatening to impose retaliatory tariffs. Joining us now is Paris, in from Paris, is reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, did the U.S. Commerce Secretary offer EU allies any reassurance?
He didn't say specifically which way he thought President Trump would decide, but he did allude to it by saying, look, even if tariffs do come into place, we can still talk trade. The avenues of communication will still be open. That really, though, was not enough for the Europeans to give them any sort of confidence. And since he made those remarks, the European Union trade officials have pretty much been sort of huddling together at this OECD meeting here in Paris and trying to figure out a way forward. Essentially, the big snag is, from the European side, is the EU, which represents all the nations of the European Union. They refuse to negotiate with the administration's demands for limits on metal shipments to the U.S. unless they receive that permanent, unconditional exception from tariffs. There's no meeting of minds there. Now, what they say is, do that and we can talk. But now the EU Trade Commissioner has said, well, you know, she made a statement to Parliament and said, well, don't think we're going to get that exemption, but we are fairly sure that what the U.S. is proposing is going to undermine the multilateral trading system that has been in place and that all of the blame goes specifically on to the U.S., she said, and because this is a unilateral initiative.
My understanding is that basically what you just said is presuming that these tariffs will be imposed.
But they really aren't holding out much hope. I mean, let's also remember that a week ago, EU leaders actually did table a concrete offer. They talked about reciprocal arrangements for products, particularly cars. something else that the American president really is unhappy about. He says that he doesn't see enough people in Germany, for example, driving Chevrolet cars, but yet in America he sees people buying and driving German-made cars. Now, German consumers say, well, we don't actually see anything that makes us want to buy American cars. Our cars are made in Europe, and they are actually adapted to our way of life. So there is that on the table. The European Union has also offered to have a reform of the World Trade Organization rules that would improve the efficiency of trade, but that so far has been rebuffed. And also just generally, and this is particularly coming from the German government, they say that they want just an overall cut in tariffs rather than an increase in tariffs, which they say is not going to help anybody.
So overall, are the leaders there expecting an all-out trade war with the United States?
They are indeed. That's exactly what they're expecting. They will respond. They say that as early as June 20th, they will have a response if these tariffs are put in. They've decided on very targeted sanctions. They've already decided on which companies and in which American states there will be tariffs against. They've particularly chosen American companies in states that are controlled by Republicans and companies that have big exports to the European Union. So these are ready to go into place if need be, but still, they're just hoping at the last minute there will be a change of mind.
If not, would you say this is a pretty big blow to free trade?
It's a huge blow, and the fact that just in the last month we have seen a dream of visitors to the White House, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, President Macron of France was there, and also today French President Emmanuel Macron made another plea. He, at this OECD meeting here in Paris, he said trade is no longer bilateral. We are living in a multilateral world, and the example he used was you have got products which are designed in California but assembled in China. And he said, what we need to do is improve multilateralism, not revert to unilateral initiatives.
All right. Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thank you. A senior North Korean official is in New York in the highest level official visit to the United States in 18 years as President Trump and Kim Jong-un seek to salvage prospects for a high-stakes nuclear summit. The official, Kim Jong-chol, met with U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo late Wednesday, with more talks scheduled Thursday. Daniel Davis is a senior fellow with defense priorities in Washington.
The most important thing they want to get out of this is an understanding of what's going to happen at the summit so that there are no surprises in there. And I think that we're going to be very frank in saying this is our position. This is what President Trump is willing to entertain. Here's some red lines. We are not even willing to talk about this. And the North Koreans are likely doing the same thing. And this is part of the negotiation to where both sides can find out, where is the room for negotiation? Where can they find common ground so that this can eventually get resolved in a way that benefits all parties?
Trump sent a letter last week to Kim Jong-un saying their proposed June 12th summit in Singapore wouldn't happen, blaming what he said was tremendous anger and open hostility shown in a statement from Pyongyang. He shortly thereafter reversed his stance on both Koreas, attempting to keep the summit on track. Ukraine's security chief now says his organization planned to have a prominent Russian war correspondent and Kremlin critic fake his own death as part of a ruse to save the reporter's life. The journalist thought dead stunned reporters when he appeared alive and well Wednesday, one day after he'd been reportedly shot and killed in the stairwell of his Kiev apartment. An official with Ukraine's security service stood alongside Arkady Babchenko at a news conference Wednesday as he recounted events leading up to the foiled assassination attempt. He explained the fictitious reports of his death were part of a sting operation that had been prepared for 2 months. Nina Jankowicz is a Russia expert with the Wilson Center's Cannon Institute. She talked about the astounding development with International Edition's Sarah Williams.
It is an extreme measure, and I think first and foremost, everyone is very relieved that Mr. Babchenko is alive. And secondly, if this does pan out for the security services, they have made one arrest, this could be a huge win for Ukraine. For so long, they have been trying to make the case that Russia is carrying out these extrajudicial assassinations within sovereign Ukraine. So to have incontrovertible public proof about that would be a huge boon for Ukraine on the international stage. It's a curious way to go about it, certainly, but if it saves Mr. Babchenko's life and provides that proof, you can understand why they might have done that.
Certainly, looking over the last few years, there have been a number of prominent Russian journalists and also other prominent officials that have suddenly been killed, mysteriously or not so mysteriously, and some killed outside Russia.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, in Ukraine, since July of 2016, there have been 5 high-profile assassinations in Kyiv alone. And the Ukrainian authorities have implicated Russia in many of those killings. I think if indeed, as I said before, this person who's been arrested was the mastermind behind them or was connected to the Russian government and its operations in Ukraine, that would be a huge win for the Ukrainian security services. But of course, you know, Ukraine is not the only place that this happens. We've seen recently an attempt on the double agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in Salisbury, the UK. And there's been a lot of questions as this report came out this morning and this afternoon about how Russia will use this information that Kyiv was slightly duplicitous in its staging of this murder in order to gain information, and whether, you know, the Russian government will then turn that around and say, well, how can we believe what, for instance, other allied governments like the UK say about the Skripal murder? And to that I say, you know, we have to be careful about reflexive control here. No matter what we, the West, do, Russia will tend to make up whatever it wants. I mean, we saw that with MH17. We see that with Skripal. It doesn't matter whether we have incontrovertible proof or not. Russia is going to advance that narrative no matter what. So to the people saying that they're feeding the Russian narrative by conducting such an operation, I think Russia would have doubted involvement in the, or tried to cast doubt on involvement, its involvement in this murder no matter what.
You can just imagine sometime this week, you know, in Moscow, some official will get up and say, well, this is an example of fake news.
Absolutely. They're already saying that. They're already saying that it's slanderous and that it's a provocation. But I think we have to remember that Russia and Ukraine are at war, number one. And number two, that Russia, this is a pattern of behavior for Russia. So I don't think we should be doing the Russian work for it by blaming the Ukrainian authorities, if indeed they do have this proof to come out, and if indeed there was this assassination plot against Mr. Babchenko, then it's great that they saved his life, and hopefully they do have that proof. If they don't, then I think there's going to be a lot of reckoning to do.
That's Nina Jankowicz, Global Fellow at the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute. Well, health workers in Democratic Republic of Congo are racing against time to contain the outbreak of Ebola. So far, the World Health Organization reports at least 27 people with more than 50 confirmed cases of the deadly virus. VOA's Carol Pearson reports efforts to vaccinate people exposed to the virus started more than 10 days ago.
People in Bikoro celebrate this man's recovery from Ebola. Mwangi Nondi says he developed a fever after caring for his brother, who died from Ebola. But Nondi is better now after receiving the Ebola vaccine. Doctors in Congo say they have not been able to vaccinate everyone who has been exposed to the virus, and they're still finding new cases that are not linked to cases they have already confirmed. This means the virus is still actively spreading, and health workers still don't have an accurate picture of what's going on. Congo's vaccination campaign is targeting more than 1,000 health workers, along with those who have had contact with people who developed the virus. They use a ring approach, where health workers identify newly diagnosed Ebola patients and then set out locating people they've been in contact with, from family and friends to neighbors and work colleagues. The vaccine they're using was developed during the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. It's not licensed yet, but it has proven to be safe and effective.
What it does, it teaches the immune system to recognize those Ebola proteins on the surface of this modified virus, and in doing so, create a protective response against that.
Because the vaccine can only be tested when there's an Ebola outbreak, there are many unknowns.
What we're trying to do now is to establish how effective is this vaccine. Do you need one dose or two doses to be protective? And once you've been injected or vaccinated with this, how long does that protection last for as well?
Containing the virus is difficult because many areas impacted by the outbreak are close to heavily used waterways. It started in rural Bigoro, then moved to Mbandaka, a busy port city along the Congo River. People use the river to bring produce to the country's capital, Kinshasa. Health workers say keeping Ebola out of heavily populated areas is critical to containing this outbreak. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, for transgender people in a conservative country like Pakistan, life starts getting tough very early. Seen as misfits in society, they're misunderstood, shirked, and forced to live away from families. While they get little help from the government for the first time, one of their own has built a senior home for them. VOA's Aisha Tanzim visited the house in Lahore and brings us this story.
Severa is HIV positive. She's also one of the thousands of transgenders in Pakistan who are routinely shunned by their families and thrown out of their houses at an early age.
My mother is the only one who loves me. No one else likes me because I am a transgender. All my relatives and neighbors make fun of me. Even my own siblings make fun of me.
Rejected by their loved ones, they usually turn to a guru, an older transgender who provides shelter and training on how to make a living. As social outcasts in a conservative society, they do not have many options for employment. Most of them dress as drag queens and dance for men at parties, work as sex workers, or beg. As they grow older, the sources of income dry up. Guru Ashif Bhatt had seen one too many transgenders left to die on the streets. So she decided to build a home for old or sick transgenders. Even that received resistance from the community.
I wanted to build it in the city, but people came to me and said, you'll keep sick transgenders here. They will have AIDS or hepatitis C. Our children will get sick and old transgenders will roam around in our neighborhood.
She was forced to move her project to an area outside the city. Here, she provides not just accommodation, but food to people like Mehek, who has polio.
I can't roam around and beg too much because I get tired. Here, even if I can go and beg every day, I don't have to worry about how I will eat or pay my rent.
This first-of-its-kind shelter home for transgenders in Pakistan can only accommodate up to 40 people. Pakistan has more than 10,000 transgenders. But wants the government to take more interest in the welfare of a neglected community in desperate need of support. Meanwhile, Severa is grateful for the reprieve since she spends all her resources trying to pay her medical bills. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Lahore.
Well, Pablo Picasso's painting of Golden Muse, Marie Therese Walter, estimated to be worth up to $45 million, is on display in Hong Kong. The highly celebrated painting of his secret mistress of many years is the highlight of a collection of treasured works of art by old master painters that will be up for sale in London. VOA's Julie Tabo has more.
A portrait of Pablo Picasso's golden muse, Marie Therese, debuted in Hong Kong on Friday, May 25th, ahead of Sotheby's summer season in London. The painting, unveiled in public for the first time in 20 years, is estimated to be worth as much as $45 million. It was painted in 1932, during Picasso's so-called Year of Wonders, when he is said to have been inspired by women, including Marie Therese and others, according to Sotheby's Augusto Uribe.
1932 is the golden year in which he really has a profoundly intimate relationship with Marie Therese. So paintings from that era, from that year in particular, are much more calm, tender, sweet. And as his relationship with her became a little more staid and slightly more antagonistic, then his depictions of her were a bit more, aggressive.
The painting is on display alongside a selection of Dutch and Flemish masterpieces before heading to London for a sale on June 19th. Classic masterpiece paintings are popular in the Asian market, says Andrew Fletcher, who heads Sotheby's Old Masters auction sales.
Collectors in Asia for Old Masters have tended in the past to come from Hong Kong. More and more, we see them coming from mainland China, from Taiwan. And we've also got more and more collectors coming from Japan as well.
Picasso, who died at the age of 91, was one of the most prolific artists of the 20th century, creating more than 13,000 paintings, along with countless prints and illustrations, in a career that spanned 78 years. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
You're listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $10 million for information leading to the identification or location of Muhammad al-Jolani, leader of the Al-Nusra Front, or ANF, terrorist group. This is the first Rewards for Justice reward offer for a leader of Al-Nusra Front, the Syrian branch of Al-Qaeda. In 2013, al-Jolani pledged allegiance to al-Qaeda and its leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, after he had a public falling out with ISIS. In 2016, in a video posted online, al-Jolani praised al-Qaeda and al-Zawahiri and claimed the ANF was changing its name to Jabhat Fath al-Sham. Under al-Jolani's leadership, ANF has carried out multiple terrorist attacks throughout Syria, often targeting civilians. In April 2015, ANF reportedly kidnapped and later released approximately 300 Kurdish civilians from a checkpoint in Syria. In June 2015, ANF claimed responsibility for the massacre of 20 residents in a Druze village in Idlib province, Syria. In January 2017, ANF merged with several other hardline opposition groups to form Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. ANF remains al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, and Jolani remains the leader of ANF, which is at the core of HTS. In 2014, ANF was designated as a foreign terrorist organization by the State Department. The same year, the UN added ANF to its sanctions list. Since its inception in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. For more information about al-Jolani, go to www.rewardsforjustice.net. We encourage anyone with information about al-Jolani to contact the Rewards for Justice office via email on the website, info@rewardsforjustice.net. by phone 1-800-877-3927 in North America, or by mail Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.